So I'm talking to Sue Gray, who is the environment lawyer for the judicial review of the EPA case. Do you want to explain more about it in words that, that make sense for me?
Yeah, sure. Hi, good morning, Sharon.
Hiya, how are you doing?
On. Yeah, great. Yeah, so the Aotea or Great Barrier Island community and some of their members took on the EPA and Coastal Resources Limited about the issue of a marine dumping licence, which would have allowed dredging from a whole series of marinas around Auckland and Waikato into this EEZ zone offshore from the Great Barrier Island. And it was a bit of a David and Goliath battle with just the island community standing up against the system. But the great news is that we won in the High Court, and as a result, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Authority, have been told that they have to go back and have another look at this decision.
Cool. So that's amazing. And do you have any idea of how much that cost to do?
The cost of going to court?
Mm.
Well, it basically depends on what you negotiate between the parties. But in this case, we had some very, very quality input from Valmaine Toki, who's an expert in a lot of Māori legal issues, which really assisted the team. I've just been looking at the scale costs, which you know, you're talking around at least $50,000 or more if for basically the standard fee, but a lot of these legal cases cost a lot more.
Mm.
So it all depends what, you know, communities can sort of pull together and what resources they can find.
Mm. Well, I remember, you know, talking to Kelly Klink of Protect Aotea and all of us scrabbling about thinking how we can challenge this. So it's just a real testament to community that, you know, everybody just worked so hard to get this done, and I'm sure lots of people did a lot of stuff that they didn't get paid for to pull that over the line. And what an amazing outcome. Because had they not won, what would have happened?
Well, the EEZ allowed the dumping. There was already a consent to dump 50,000 cubic metres of dredge waste out beyond east of Great Barrier Island each year, and this application was to allow five times more, so 250,000 cubic metres of dredge waste. And, you know, the dredge waste potentially contains contaminants that have sort of leached in from boats, you know, heavy metals and all sorts of different things, potentially biosecurity organisms that have been come from the Pacific Islands or wherever the boats have come from. So it's quite a big question, dumping this out in the high seas to start with. I mean, a lot of people are pretty offended by the whole idea of it, but it was just the way it was done was even more concerning in this case.
Mm.
So the usually there would be some sort of proper consultation, but in this case the consultation was mainly done with the people in Auckland who would benefit from it, and very little consultation was done with the people of Great Barrier Island who suffered most of the harm from this proposal if it were to go ahead. And that's really what the islanders thought was unfair. The whole process
and
was
I think
sort of set up and rigged against.
And I think the hearings were in fact held in Auckland, weren't they?
Look, there was a whole series of problems. It wasn't the consultation was very lax. So the EPA has a Māori Advisory Committee which gave them advice on how the consultation should be done, but they chose to ignore that advice. They originally said that they would hold the hearings wherever there were the most residents who submitted. Their first count-up was that mainly they were from Auckland, so they had the hearings in Auckland. But what they didn't look at was a lot of people had said Great Barrier Island, Auckland. And so they'd been counted as Auckland submitters rather than Great Barrier Island submitters.
Right,
and when they had another look at it, they found that there were actually more submitters from Great Barrier Island. Then they did crazy things like advertised in the New Zealand Herald, which most people on Great Barrier don't get or read, and claimed that that was adequate notification in the newspaper. And so there were a whole series of these type of things. And the main issue was the issue with consulting with tangata whenua. So the Māori Advisory Council Committee said, you must consult widely. There are all of these different Māori interests in the region who may be affected. This is what you need to do. Go and talk to all of them, find out what their concerns are, what their interests are, and have a sort of a broad approach. But instead, the applicant really chose to just consult with a very few, and in some cases with part of a hapu that was in Auckland, but where the other half on Great Barrier were not consulted with. So it was really a cumulative effect of only looking at what suited them and ignoring the views of the people who were most affected.
Indeed. And that decision also wasn't heard by the Environment Court, was it? It was a decision by the EPA?
Yeah, so it was the EPA, and they delegated it to a committee of their own, so they chose a sort of like a subcommittee. But the process under the EZ Act is that the EPA does the first round of decisions and the right of appeal is to the High Court.
Which really puts community on the back foot. So it's, you know, because that's immediately quite a considerable cost to take that to the High Court, isn't it?
Absolutely. And look, that's really the lesson out of this is do it right the first time, because it saves everybody a lot of grief. If there's wide consultation, if all of the issues can be on the table, and if it can be done through that first EPA process, because you don't need a lawyer to go to the EPA. Anybody can make a submission. Anybody's got the right to be heard. So if the EPA had a much more inclusive process in the first place, and or if the applicant had have chosen to spend more time talking to local people about how they might be affected, hopefully we would have got a much better decision in the first place, and it would have saved having to go to the High Court, because the High Court is a pretty scary process for most people.
Well, indeed. And so can you comment on the significance of the decision? What does this mean for community groups who are you know, battling decisions in different parts of the system, and especially decisions like this, which seem so against the environment? Like, on the one hand, we're all sort of encouraged not to use plastic bags and, you know, take our reusable cups around, and then at the same time, governments and agencies are making wholesale destructive decisions that we have no visibility of.
Absolutely. And look, you've raised a really good point there, Sharon, because it's all very well for the people to stand up and say, look, we need to look after our planet more carefully. But if the government and the major decision makers are not going to adopt that view, it makes it really, really hard for communities. So what's come out of this is that communities can stand up when a wrong's been done. And if they put a good case forward, they can win in the High Court. And what it means now is it's very clear in future, consultation must be full and frank, and it must be with all of the community interests. They can't just take these shortcuts and keep taking them. So it applies directly to the EZ Act, but it also applies to the Resource Management Act, to the Department of Conservation when they're consulting, because they also have to give effect to the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi. And so the same type of thing, you can't just choose one entity that you know is going to agree with you and ignore all the other ones that have got some quite legitimate concerns. So it's really a wake-up call for a lot of these government organisations to have a bit of a re-look at how they're doing things and do it better. And because they're actually there to represent the community, and sometimes I think they forget, because they get lobbied quite strongly by some of the more wealthier interests, and they forget that they're actually there looking after our planet, our people, our communities for the future. On every level, really, this is a really great decision to just remind us all that people power is important and it's worth making the effort.
No, indeed. I think it was a really hopeful message in terms of the other things that we deal with, because I think there's also a Ports of Auckland dumping application for something similar and fairly close by, which has gone through a similar process, but not through the Environmental Protection Agency, more through Auckland Council decision making. And then there's also a dredging consent to take that dump out to the same area, and I think that closes next week. So does this, have you got any thoughts about that?
Yeah, so I understand there's two applications. One is basically to dredge in the Auckland Harbour, and I think the Auckland Council's dealing with that side of it. And I haven't been following that process, but I know that Kelly Clink and some of the others have. Really, really important for the public to get involved with that, because there's a lot of concern internationally about dredging harbour waste and all the stirring up of what it can do, and especially after the big fire, what went into the harbour. You know, there are all these other toxins that we haven't dealt with in the past. So that's one side of it. The other side of it is then, if that waste is dredged, where is it going to be dumped? And there's an application, which is the one you've mentioned, to dump that just to the northeast of Great Barrier Island in the EZ there. And that's where the community really does need to get involved. If people don't want waste, harbour waste, dumped in the EZ, then they need to tell the decision makers that, and they need to tell them why. And cultural, spiritual concerns, environmental concerns, they're all really important.
Mm, indeed, indeed. Okay, great. I mean, I'm just reflecting on I don't know if you know, but I think yesterday or maybe the day before, I'm not entirely sure, I just saw it yesterday, the decision to refuse a rehearing to the Save Kennedy Point in terms of the marina application was rejected yesterday, which means that there won't be a rehearing. And I'm talking to Seb in about half an hour, and he's the lawyer for SKP. But I think in terms of what you've been saying and some of the arguments that were made around who has the mandate and who can speak on behalf of the iwi, and in any case, how a community voice is being represented, is a really pertinent question.
Yeah, look, it's really, I don't know any of the details of that case, but what I've learnt from this EEZ case is there was a right of appeal under the EEZ Act, but the court had previously interpreted that in a very, very narrow way. So what we did with the for the Great Barrier community was we appealed, but we also judicially reviewed it, the decision. And the judicial review gave us some much more wider grounds of appeal, so all of the natural justice, fair process type grounds, as well as some of the legal grounds. So that, you know, and the so it's really worth pitching your argument very carefully, spend the time at the start to look at all of the possible arguments and then work out which one's the strongest.
Mm-hmm. So how can people get involved? Because, you know, the kinds of things you've just been saying, I'm sure, you know, some of our listeners will be really interested in this. And some of us will just be going, oh, this is just really too complex. Like, how can I have a view, or how can I get involved with these processes when I feel that basically this is not the right thing to be doing, but the way of challenging something is so complex? Like, I'm sure a lot of people would just find making a submission quite a challenge.
Yeah, and it is, and unfortunately the system has been designed like that, and it needs to change. It needs to be fit for purpose so that people do have a say in the world that we live in. You know, what kind of world do we want to live in? If we don't make these big decisions, our rights get frittered away, our environment gets damaged, and everything sort of goes backwards, and we suddenly say, hey, how did that happen? So really there's joining a group, voting very carefully next year to vote for a future that we do want, working with others in the community to research, to understand what's going on, to find alternatives, to find best practices from around the world. There's a lot of people getting involved. I've been doing a lot of work on 5G radiation that people don't want, that's been sneaked out on us without really any consultation at all, and the usual council rights even have been taken away. And people are saying, how did this happen? Well, it happened because we let it. It happened while we were busy doing other things. So we've actually got to make a stand and work together, divvy up some tasks. You can have a lot of fun working with a group of like-minded people and turn things around, because otherwise we're not really going to have the kind of planet and place that we want anymore.
Mm. And I think you're right. I mean, for me, I find that getting involved with things can actually be, like you said, a lot of fun. And not everyone has to be on the legal side. You can get people who are interested in fundraising and just, you know, organising events, or even just talking up some of the issues.
Exactly. Look, educate yourself, educate your family, educate your neighbours, it's actually a great way to connect back with your community, that, that people start talking about these things. My daughter went to a school exchange over in Germany a few years ago, and she was amazed. In New Zealand, the kids didn't talk about politics and environmental issues or anything. They sort of talked about sports and what they were doing in the weekend and that kind of thing. In Germany, they were so much more informed, and it really raised her awareness. And they are trying to be clean and green over there. In New Zealand, we've been missing the boat a bit. But, you know, hey, let's start. Let's change the way we do things, because if we really do want to look after our beautiful country, we do have to get informed, and we do have to engage, and we do find like-minded people, and then we can do some miracles.
Well, I've often reflected on Waiheke. We have a whole bunch of people who are really passionate about the island, and, you know, it's not coincidental that we still look relatively undeveloped in relation to other parts of you know, Auckland. I mean, I know we are separated by water, but nonetheless, I think, you know, over time there have been a lot of people who've stood up and stepped forward for the island specifically to take detailed looks at planning decisions and to challenge some of those. And yeah, sadly, that's part of what we have to do to maintain the beauty of where we live.
But it's worth it, isn't it? Isn't it great? You've got the communities like Waiheke, Nelson, where I live. I've just been up in Gisborne. They've got some great people doing great community work up there, absolutely fantastic work on well-being and cultural issues, a whole range of things. And I've just been down to Queenstown as well, another great bunch of people down there working to look after their environment, because they're under threat from all the development and just a massive explosion of tourism. If we don't fight for what we want, we're not going to keep it.
So true. And I think the other thing is we sometimes fight in isolation and then we don't realise. Like, I know sometimes it's a surprise, you know, you forget that people are fighting similar challenges, like for us, all around the Hauraki Gulf, whether it's in the Coromandel, Aotea, Great Barrier or here. You know, some of those challenges around protecting the marine environment are very similar.
Absolutely. And look, that's why it's so great talking to people and connecting with like-minded people. And then you find that there's actually a massive team that at least largely agree on issues. And instead of fighting alone, you've got a whole network.
Indeed. Now, another question then. So 5G, do you have any thoughts of where the impetus for this is coming from? Like, why? Because when I look at, you know, why you'd bring 5G in, aside from, you know, what it might mean in terms of health or this and that, It doesn't seem to be driven by a need.
No, I think it's driven by greed rather than need and money. Look, we've got a really, really good fibre optic network through much of New Zealand. The government invested $2 billion was allocated $2 billion by August 2017 on the grounds that it would give us all the connectivity we needed for the foreseeable future. And it doesn't apply everywhere in New Zealand, but most of the major parts of New Zealand, the major communities have got fibre optic cable. And what 5G is doing is the opposite. It's for for wireless connections, but it doesn't even work inside at all. So it's basically, if you want a driverless car, if you want to faster download video games on your cell phone or for the Internet of Things, then 5G may have some advantages. But if you compare that against the health risks, the environmental risks, the risk to our trees, bees and all the other species that we haven't even really looked into, the security risks, do we really want to put all of those other things at risk for a new technology that we don't even need? And for me, with 5G, the first thing we need to do is have a conversation about it. Again, it's very much like this EEZ case, where a few vested interests have decided what they want and they've taken steps to avoid consulting with everybody else. So let's just slow down 5G, take a bit of time, have a bit of a think about it. Do we need it? If we want it in some parts of New Zealand, well, let's work out where and why and how those people are protected. But let's not expose all of us to some technology that someone thinks that we should have because they might be able to make some money out of it.
And so does that kind of aligning with some sort of precautionary principle? Let's just have a bigger discussion and decide where we need it rather than just whole scale rolling it out.
Yeah. Look, precautionary principle, but even democracy. I mean, what's happened with 5G is the telcos have pushed for various regulations to be changed so that they can roll out their technology as of right under the Resource Management Act without any community consultation and even excluding the councils. So what's starting to happen now, councils all around New Zealand are getting really fired up because they're getting a lot of submissions from their communities saying, hey, what's going on here? Why are you allowing this? And they're saying, well, actually, we've been excluded from the process as well. So we're responsible for health and safety effects and visual effects and all these other things that our communities don't want. And we've been taken out of the loop. What is going on? So I think there's going to be a big community fight back over the next few months. There's an international day of protest about 5G on the 25th of January, and communities all around New Zealand are planning different activities on that day to raise awareness about 5G. And they're also, we're looking at a court challenge. We're looking at, there's a lot of petitions being prepared for Parliament. We're asking our decision makers to slow down, listen to the people, especially because next year's election year, let's make it a voting issue. Let's make it an issue for democracy, because 5G, unlike like the EZ case, is affecting the Great Barrier community a lot, and good for them, they've stood up and been heard. But 5G is affecting all of us, all around New Zealand, whether you live in a city, in a rural area, it's going to affect you if this goes ahead. There are already people getting really sick from some of the new cell towers. Woman in Queenstown, her son has been having constant nosebleeds, her cat stopped meowing and just fell asleep. Her dog became extremely anxious. She took them away. They all came back to normal again, came back to the home with this massive cell tower just sort of a few 50 metres away across a metal neighbouring roof, which seems to be reflecting it into her bedroom window. There's been no thought at all and no caring at all about how these things are rolled out. So
there seem to be a few different things, because to be honest, I can see a lot of people going, woo, you know, like, oh, the cat, and, oh, you know, she's probably all a bit hysterical and paranoid, so how would you even know? And is that a useful way of, because there seem to be a few different things at play. One, that some people feel that they are affected, their health is affected. Yeah. Then you have other people going, oh, well, you know, it's just a continuum, and what's your problem? And then there seem to be other issues around democracy and how things are rolled out in the public space.
Yeah. So, okay, so it is a continuum, but it's a continuum of a technology that's relatively very new and which is already causing significant harm to a lot of people all around the world. So it is more of the same in a way, but it's also microwave radiation on top of all the harm we're getting from the existing cell phones. So we already know that significant use of cell phones for at least 10 years causes a significant increase in brain tumours. And it's only half an hour a day per day for 10 years is showing up a significant increase in brain tumours. Mm-hmm. So it's not even heavy use in the, compared to what some people think of heavy use of cell phones. The issue about some people are more sensitive than others, and some people are electrosensitive, which is basically like an allergy. So we protect people with a peanut allergy, and yet people who are allergic to electromagnetic radiation from cell towers and cell phones have really got nowhere to go. They've got it exposed all around their environment 24/7. They can choose not to use a cell phone, but at the moment they can't choose to stay away from a cell tower or other transmitter because they're just springing up everywhere without consultation. And even if they move, chances are a new one will spring up somewhere just down the street from where they moved to.
Mm. So, and if cell towers are so wonderful, then why is it that property values go down as soon as one, you know, happens near where people live?
Exactly.
I always find that quite interesting.
And that's a very good point. Look, if the whole technology is so wonderful, let's have a fully informed conversation about it, and presumably the public will then say, yes, it's wonderful, we'll take the risks and we'll have it. But what I'm finding is it's the opposite. The telcos are telling us it's wonderful, but the more the public become informed, the more the public are saying, actually, no, there's nothing from this that we need. We would rather be precautionary, slow it down. We've got enough. We've got fibre optic in our homes. We've got 3 and 4G already in our streets, that's enough for what we need. And, you know, if there might be the occasional business that needs a particularly special amount of technology, well, let them have that technology in their business, but not exposing the whole community to it.
Mm. I mean, I find as a teacher, one of the things I think about, and this isn't 5G particularly, but it's just the whole infiltration over quite a very few years of the internet technology, Wi-Fi, access to, you know, an online world, which has really changed in the last, what would probably be 10, 15 years. Mm. And I think for me, that's what I'm concerned about, having adolescent children and just watching how people are constantly tapped into their phones. And, you know, the idea of not even being able to, you know, gaming is a huge industry, probably for, you know, there's not that much visibility of gaming around the, you know, whatever 40, 50 pluses. But in the younger generations, they game a lot. So the idea that you could be gaming off your cell phone and doing, you know, augmented reality war games and also just being switched into the system so much, I think those are social concerns that are not necessarily only about 5G, but I think they're significant.
Absolutely. And look, it's another thing. We haven't really had the conversation about it. New Zealand was busy putting Wi-Fi into schools at the very time that France and Israel were taking it out of their schools because of a range of different concerns they'd identified. The OECD did a report a few years ago about technology in schools and found that some technology is good, but more is not better. There's an optimum, and if you have too much, performance goes backwards. And look, that's exactly what we've been seeing in New Zealand. We used to be ranking much higher against the rest of the world in math, science and reading, but we've actually gone backwards as we've introduced this Wi-Fi technology into our schools. And it's not really surprising because we know that radiation interferes with thinking, memory and learning. Well, wouldn't you think that in a classroom, thinking, memory and learning are the most important things, and we wouldn't be wanting technology that interferes with that and diverts us from that.
Mm. Yeah, and again, I mean, not necessarily related to 5G, but I think it's also that thing of they're feeling that mediated paperless classrooms are maybe not that great because the texture of books and page turning and underlining with a pen and using your hand to write things down are actually really important skills that are kind of being lost through mediating everything. Really interesting. Are there other projects that you're working on that are quite interesting that you can share, not the details of, but in general?
Yep, there's a lot that I'm doing with 5G at the moment and related radiation and also just the whole people power. Really, I'm really interested in getting people back into decision making and getting vision into what we do, because what I've seen over the last 20 or so years is power is getting aggregated to less and less people, and it's getting harder and harder for the public to have a say in the environment. So I've really become specialised in working with communities to help them have a voice. And the sad thing is, if they want to have a voice and they want to be heard, they basically have to make a big fuss. Now, that doesn't really suit everybody. You shouldn't have to make a big fuss just to have your rights listened to. Excuse me. So what I'm really interested in doing is working through the way our systems have developed and trying to turn things around so that instead of centralisation of decision making, we get it back to communities, that communities have a say in the decisions. And we celebrate that different communities are different instead of trying to find this sort of one McDonaldization of our place.
Mm. Well, that sounds amazing. So, Sue, thank you so much for all the work you do for us and, you know, in community, because I know that often communities really struggle to find a lawyer that's patient enough to deal with, you know, community groups, because they can be quite complex and require a different level of engagement. You know, fabulous win, I think, for the environment and all of us who live around the Gulf.
Well, thanks, Sharon. And look, thank you for what you're doing as well, because I know you spend a massive amount of time on all of these different issues, and it's people like you that get the information out there and get people talking, and that's what we need. It's absolutely brilliant.
Ah, cool. Thank you. Okay, well, you have a lovely day.
Thank you. You too.
Okay, bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, so that was Sue Gray talking about the EPA decision, the Environmental Protection Agency decision to dump near Barrier.